Local news, culture, and NPR.
Good morning. Israel attacked Iranian military and nuclear sites. The targets range from a nuclear enrichment facility to Iranian science.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Coming up on today's show, Sullivan County rolls out a $30 million plan to connect thousands of homes to high-speed internet. For decades, the county's mountainous terrain in the Catskills has hindered that broadband expansion. Will it finally go through? We'll find out more. Plus, Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government. He'll have more news on that and also some news about tipping fees and other transfer-related garbage issues from the legislature. The Deepwater Literary Festival is back in Narrowsburg with something for all readers, including kids. Plus, the latest episode of Curtain Call. It's coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel is continuing to strike targets deep inside Iran today. Israeli officials say they're targeting Iranian nuclear facilities and military sites. Since the war began in Gaza in 2023, Israel has fought several of Iran's proxies, such as Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. NPR's James Hyder reports Israel is saying it needed to act against Iran now.
While that loss of proxies may have left Iran weakened, it's also increased the chances that Iran might finally be tempted to build a nuclear weapon as the ultimate last line of defense. And Israel said that it was taking out what it called a secret weapons program to build multiple nuclear weapons. And of course, the White House had not ruled out the use of force against Iran. Even if President Trump had said he preferred diplomacy, he'd also said repeatedly that the time might come when military strikes would be necessary, and Israel is now saying that that moment had come.
NPR's James Hyder reporting. Stocks fell sharply this morning after Israel's attack on Iran sparked a big jump in oil prices. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled 600 points in early trading.
Crude oil prices saw their biggest jump since Russia's invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago. The benchmark price in the U.S. climbed to around $73 a barrel. Whether that high price is sustained will depend on whether there's any lasting impact on Middle East oil supplies. Retail gasoline prices in the U.S. remain low for now. AAA reports the average price of regular gasoline is about $3.13 a gallon. That's a penny less than a week ago and 33 cents less than this time last year. Stock in one of the world's largest meat processors began trading today on the New York Stock Exchange. The Brazil-based company JBS is the biggest producer of beef in the U.S. and the second largest supplier of chicken and pork. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. will celebrate the anniversary of the U.S. Army tomorrow with a massive parade in Washington, D.C. It's also President Trump's birthday tomorrow. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports some defense experts worry that could blur a line between patriotism and politics.
While the event is officially billed as a celebration of the military's 250th anniversary, some experts say the optics are complicated by its timing. Yvonne Chu is a professor at the Naval War College. She says holding the parade on the president's 79th birthday has raised some questions.
It is bad optics at best, especially when if you were really interested in promoting the military and reinforcing patriotism, that he could choose July 4th. It is 3 weeks later. It is a much more obvious date.
The White House and supporters of the administration say they see the parade as a tribute to the nation's armed forces. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. A second federal judge has temporarily blocked more of President Trump's recent executive order on voting around the country. U.S. District Judge Denise Casper halted Trump's order that requires people to provide proof of citizenship when they're registering to vote. She also temporarily blocked Trump's efforts to get rid of the grace period for mail-in ballots if they are postmarked by Election Day but arrive afterward. Officials in India say they have recovered one of the flight data recorders from the Air India jet that crashed yesterday in western India. Only one person aboard the flight survived. More people on the ground were killed. A popular climate change website says it will stop publishing new information at the end of the month. As NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports, the Trump administration cut all the staff at the climate.gov website.
Climate.gov gets nearly a million visitors each month. It publishes up-to-date information about weather patterns like tornado outbreaks, as well as drought conditions and other climate-related phenomena like wildfire smoke. 10 people used to work on content for the website. 3 of them were let go under a government-wide purge of probationary employees, meaning those who were either new or recently promoted. The former program manager for the site, Rebecca Lindsay, says the remaining climate.gov staff were let go in recent weeks. That means the site will be unable to publish new content after the end of the month, although previously published information will still be available. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Dan Hoost is here. We'll speak with him in just a moment. But first, if you live in Sullivan County, high-speed internet may be coming to your home or small business soon. Yesterday, Sullivan County kicked off a $30 million broadband project through New York State's Connect All program that will bring high-speed internet to homes and businesses throughout the county's mountainous terrain. That terrain has hindered that expansion for decades. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was at the kickoff in Bethel, New York, and brings us this report.
Pick up a little dirt and get ready to toss it. Ready? Okay. Ready? One, two, three, go.
County officials and community leaders picked up their shovels and construction hats to mark the kickoff of Sullivan County's $30 million broadband project that'll connect over 22,000 homes and small businesses to high-speed internet. On Thursday, Sullivan County launched the project at Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. The initiative is expected to bring broadband services throughout the county by the end of 2026 and is funded through New York State's municipal infrastructure program, Connect All. Governor Kathy Hochul stated in a press release that, quote, "Today marks a historic turning point for Sullivan County. We're finally bridging the gap that has held too many communities for far too long," end quote. Sullivan County Legislature Chair Nadia Raj said that this project gives the county the same access to high-speed internet as any other city, but in a rural community.
Many spots throughout Sullivan County are not served by anything broadband. There's no internet service to the majority of this county, sometimes even without any wires. The future is here, so let's get started.
The project marks the single largest broadband investment in Sullivan County's history. While the county will own the infrastructure, Archtop Fiber, an internet and phone service provider in the Hudson Valley, will serve as the internet provider. Sullivan County's IT Services Commissioner, Lauren Green, said that the vision for the project was born 8 years ago.
The vision of what tomorrow will bring as a result of high-speed fixed wireless and fiber to the homes and businesses of this county we call home is transformational. A sample of how. On the economic development front, residents can access remote jobs, start online businesses, and participate in the digital economy. Local businesses can expand their customer base, engage in e-commerce, and improve operations. Farmers can use precision agricultural tools, real-time weather data, and market analytics to boost productivity. In education, students can participate in remote learning, access educational resources, and complete assignments online.
Green says that the expansion of high-speed internet will be a game-changer for so many industries, including healthcare and agriculture. Patients can manage chronic conditions without long travel times. Farmers can have real-time access to wildlife tracking, emergencies, and land conservation, says Green. But the internet also brings us together.
On quality of life issues, through social connections, it can help reduce isolation by enabling video calls, social media, and online communities, especially important for our seniors. In entertainment and culture, it can provide access to news, music, movies, cultural programming otherwise unavailable locally. My personal favorite, especially with having older children with young families, retaining existing and attracting new residents. Reliable high-speed internet can help reverse rural depopulation by making communities more livable for families and young professionals.
Sean Bakai, co-founder of Archtop Fiber, explained the details behind the public and private partnership.
What it's going to be is 220 miles of fiber optic
that is really future-proofed. We're using a high-count fiber, as much as 864-count fiber, all underground, so it's going to be incredibly resistant to the spicy Sullivan County winters and ice storms. And we're going to be attaching 12 different 911 or county towers, which from them we will be projecting a fixed wireless play with some gear that is truly multi-gig capable. And then from there will be roughly 22,000 locations serviceable off of this network immediately.
At the launch event, several speakers spoke to the contributions of two community leaders who couldn't be there. Former Sullivan County legislator Michael Brooks, who died in March, oversaw the Broadband Local Development Corporation to bring high-speed internet to underserved communities. And Sullivan County native Alan Gary, founder of Cablevision Industries, who started his television business by installing antennas on mountaintops, was also recognized.
More than half a century ago, he foresaw the promise and potential in stringing cable around Sullivan County to provide crystal-clear TV signals to our mountainous region. He brought the world to people who couldn't even get a signal over the air.
Bakai says Archtop Fiber is looking to have a shovel in the ground by August 1st. Diane Quineau, co-founder of Archtop Fiber, said that customers will see some disruption as construction kicks off, but that they'll try and keep the community as informed as they can.
If anybody has done any active construction, it's messy, right? But we make it better, and we clean it up, and we have a whole restoration. So we announce with construction. We do door hangers. We do open town hall meetings. We actually put out press. We really try to over-communicate it, as Sean mentioned. And then we also have a pretty robust online presence. To actually start nurturing campaigns. So we go out and tell people, if you want to know about it, sign up online, and we'll keep you notified as we come to town. As we get closer, 90 days out, we start telling customers and businesses that we're coming. We're about 90 days out. And then as we get closer and within 30, we actually start signing customers up.
In Bethel, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And joining us now, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, who joins us every Friday. Dan Hoost, exciting news about that broadband project being officially kicked off.
Yeah, we really think it's going to be transformative because, yes, people have options already. They have satellite. I think Starlink now has come up. Spectrum is in the area. But everything costs money. We are hoping that this new service actually will be the cheapest of all the options. Plus, it will be something that is unique insofar as it's wireless, other than if you count the cell phone signals, which really, though, you're going off the cell signal. We're actually going to be offering, or through Archtop Fiber, a true wireless broadband signal between 1 to 8 gig speed, which is faster than most anything you can get currently locally. And that'll allow us to reach into areas of Sullivan County that it wouldn't be economical or feasible to go with actual wired cable, fiber optic cable. That's long been a sticking point for people in our more remote areas. But just like electricity, it's really become an essential service, almost like utility. And the county has been very focused for many years on trying to make this happen. We went through several different mutations of this, but finally hit on the right mix with this public-private partnership with Archtop Fiber. And, of course, the state saw that through their Connect All program and awarded us the largest single grant in county history, $30 million, or $29.9, but who's counting?
Round up.
Yes, $30 million, and this needs to be done by the end of 2026. So Archtop Fiber, first thing they're going to be doing later this year is wiring up a dozen of our emergency communication towers, which will then be able to broadcast and receive wireless broadband signal. And then they'll also be working on spreading their wired network throughout the county. There was a map put up. I'll put another map up, too, today on our social media about where those wires are going to go, the main fiber of it. The real cool thing about that is, with very few exceptions, that wire is going to be buried underground. You're not going to see more wires on poles. You won't see this wire at all.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some other news from the legislature. So a few things popping up here. And Treasurer Nancy Buck reporting sales tax down in the last remittance from the state. What's happening there, and how much was it?
This is happening to municipalities all across the state and probably the country too. I haven't looked that far, but we were down by 55,000, 100,000 since January total that we're down by. What goes up must come down, I guess. We sort of thought we were plateauing at a historic amount of sales tax that we had collected. I think close to around $80 million, where less than a decade ago we were collecting $30 million, $40 million. So we're not looking at a return to $30 or $40 million collection, but we are definitely looking at a slowdown, I think, in people's pace of buying in some of the construction in Sullivan County. Right now, we don't have anything specific that we're attributing it to. You can make up your own mind as to whether what's happening at the federal level has anything to do with it, or if people are just taking a step back because wages are slowing down too. I don't know what the actual reason is, other than we pay attention to it, because for the first time in a long time in the past few years, sales tax has outpaced property tax in revenue for Sullivan County. We'd like it to stay that way, but of course we can't control how much people are spending on items that are sales taxable. So we are going to keep particularly our treasurer, Nancy Buck, is going to keep a very close eye on how this is going, because it will impact our budget planning for 2026.
Is there an expectation that things might pick up because of the summer season, the traditional busier season for tourism and folks spending money?
There could be. But we're not necessarily counting on that. It's never wise to assume that you're going to get more than you did before. And, of course, after September, that slacks off even in the best of years. So we're looking right now at, and we're anticipating that it'll probably be less, not necessarily significantly less, but less sales tax collection for 2025 than for 2024.
Treasurer Buck also noted that the county, like other municipalities, even businesses, has been the victim of fraudulent check activity with some scammers doing their work. What's happening there, and how much is that impacting?
This was disturbing to find. I didn't know this until she talked about it yesterday in one of our committee meetings of legislature. Was that we've had, I think just over this past year, $214,000 worth of fraudulent check activity. And typically what it is we're mailing out checks to vendors and they get intercepted, and the scammers then erase the name of the vendor and put their own name on it. They don't necessarily change the amount. Some of them, though, have been a little sloppy in how they've been doing it, thank goodness. And we've been able to track them down and take appropriate action with that. But there are others where we've had to work with the bank, and in the end, somebody sort of loses that money, whether it's us or the bank, and that's not acceptable. So we are looking into more direct deposit alternatives where there is no check involved. Or if there is a check involved, because some people, and we are obligated legally to provide the check where it's requested, we do what's called positive pay, which I had never heard of this before. But basically, you send to the bank a list of the payees that you issued.
Come from your account.
Yes, so that they can check, okay, this payee is not on the list of payees that you said you issued checks to this week or month. I don't know what the time period is. And then they will not honor that check because the payee doesn't match anyone that we have on our list of having issued checks to.
Hmm. How much is this impacting the county? How much is well, so far to date?
It's a $300 million budget, and we're talking about $214,000.
Still a lot of money.
It's still money that is taxpayers' money. Mm-hmm. And our treasurer, Nancy Buck, takes this very seriously, and she's been working with, you know, just as we all know, just when you think you've got the scammers figured out, they come up with some new tactic to steal money. But law enforcement is involved, obviously, and we are actively taking steps to safeguard this kind of money going out so that we can minimize this as much as possible.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, who joins us every Friday with an update from Monticello. And now we're going to talk trash. Dan.
Oh, boy.
one of those things that people are talking about.
You always scare me with your trash talk.
A couple of things going on when it relates to waste. Legislators have been talking about increasing the tipping fees, but now they're saying we're just going to leave it flat. What's going on there?
Well, it was increased at the turn of the year for MSW, which is municipal solid waste. That's basically the kind of waste, you know, you and I bring. Most of the time, though, we're not bringing it like commercial haulers are, where it's measured in tons rather than in bags. So the tipping fee, which is the rate we charge those commercial haulers to dump, had risen to $136.50 a ton at the turn of the year for MSW. It also was at $150 a ton for what's called C&D, construction and demolition debris. The thought process was that July 1st that it would be raised for MSW to match C&D so that everything would be $150 a ton. The idea behind that with legislators was that the system needs to subsidize itself rather than taxpayers subsidizing it to really pay for itself. However, there's been pushback from commercial haulers. There's also been a big concern that haulers are going to neighboring municipalities, Orange County, Pennsylvania, which is against the county's rules, but very difficult to enforce. So legislators decided, you know, let's keep it at $136.50 a ton for MSW and not make any of this issue worse.
And they were going outside the county because the tipping fees in those locations you mentioned
are cheaper.
Were lower. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're keeping it at $136.50 instead of the original plan of raising it to $150.
Right. So come July 1st, it'll stay as it has been for MSW. It'll still be $150 a ton for construction and demolition debris.
Some talk about consolidating transfer stations. Why is that? Why do legislators think we should consolidate?
Some legislators. I don't know that it's a majority yet, because I think this is going to be a pretty hot button issue when it really gets going. But there was some talk made of it publicly yesterday by the chair of the Public Works Committee, Joe Perrello. Also, District 9 Legislator Terry Blosser Bernardo, feeling that it's not fair when certain taxpayers, like in the town of Bethel, or I think town of Fallsburg, pay for municipal solid waste pickup and disposal, and then also have to pay at the county level for municipal solid waste disposal, not pickup. And there's an idea that with some legislators that other towns and villages should mirror what those towns are doing and actually handle the solid waste disposal themselves. That is definitely going to be discussed further. I'm sure the towns will have some things to say about it. We had other legislators, like I think Legislator Kat Scott, who was like, no, in the rural western area, this is an essential service that the towns maybe individually can't pay for. So she didn't necessarily feel it would be fair for them, especially if it resulted, for example, in the consolidation, as they're talking about, of some transfer stations. Now, what if you, instead of traveling to the Western Sullivan Station in Coshecton, you're instead going to Ferndale or Livingston Manor or Monticello? Those are things the county's looking into. No decisions have been made about anything, but I think there's going to be public discussion about that from the public along with legislators. There is no consensus that I've seen yet with legislators, but they are talking about it because the cost of the system, which we're not mandated by law to provide, solid waste disposal is not mandated for counties to provide, is a significant cost.
How does this play into the larger issue of the solid waste problem in the county, where there is no landfill and it's all getting trucked up to Seneca Falls, which might be closing? We're not sure what the status of that is. The longer term, bigger issue, how does consolidating transfer stations help with that?
Well, if Seneca Meadows closes and we have to ship waste even farther outside of the county, the costs are going to increase even further. And as we just spoke about with like the tipping fees and things, there's only so far you can raise that amount before there's pushback on that. So then taxpayers get caught paying even more. And like some of the legislators were saying, in some towns, taxpayers basically are paying double for solid waste disposal, the town level and also at the county level. So there's this thought that it needs to be a fairer system for everyone. But like I said, I think there's going to be different interpretations of what the fairest solution is going to be there. So stay tuned on this one.
There'll be more.
I don't have any answers other than to tell you now that this is a discussion item. It started being discussed yesterday at the Public Works Committee, and I think it's going to accelerate as a discussion. I certainly will try to keep you up to date as we're going along here. So if you have concerns or want to register, though, how you feel about the issue, contact your legislator. They will want to hear from you. And I tell people, don't wait for the meetings. Go talk to them behind the scenes. Their phone numbers are available. Their emails are available. Find them in the grocery store. That's what they were elected for. Talk to them.
They're not one-on-one. Not just working on Thursday.
Yeah.
The legislature also passed a resolution opposing cuts to Medicaid. Sort of a statement that I, you know, for lack of better terminology, doesn't have a lot of teeth to it, and necessarily it's not going to stop it. No.
But this was something I believe legislator Kat Scott introduced in the committee she chairs, Health and Human Services, and basically mirroring, I think, some other resolutions saying that Medicaid's a vital public health insurance program. I'm reading from the resolution here, that provides access to essential medical services for millions of low-income Americans, including children, the elderly, individuals with disabilities, and working families. And more than one in three New Yorkers receive their health care through the current federal, state, county-financed health insurance partnership through Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. So the resolution is urging the president, the U.S. Congress, and all relevant federal agencies to oppose any cuts to Medicaid funding and to instead commit to strengthening and expanding this essential program.
Yes, and I just to clarify, I meant that they're not taking some sort of legislative action in order to something here, but it is important to go on record with their statement.
Yeah, no, and I understood what you mean. It's really just taking a stand. But honestly, let's be realistic about it. Yes. So is this necessarily going to even make it to the president's desk in the White House? I don't know. But it's to demonstrate to taxpayers and citizens that the legislature feels as strongly about this as we think the majority of Sullivan County does.
The airport terminal in Sullivan County largely finishing their construction this coming week. When will the flights start arriving?
flights have been ongoing. The runway has not closed. We hope to attract more business aviation companies as we go along. So we were under a deadline from the $18.5 million state grant that we got for this to finish by actually the end of May, but they allowed us to move it to the end of June just to finish a few things up. We're still ahead of most of the other, I think there were eight other upstate airports that got this kind of significant funding from Governor Kathy Hochul. And we are, quote, officially, I'm doing air quotes for anyone who can't see it, done on June 18th. However, we still have what they call a punch list to go through. There'll be little different things that we have to finish up, but largely the construction will be complete. And we expect possibly as someone as big as the governor, but some pretty senior state officials to come down maybe in July or thereabouts to do an official ribbon cutting for the facility. It is a beautiful facility. We are going to open it up to the public officially probably in a few weeks here, so that, you know, if you want to just stop by and see what was done with it, you can.
But just to clarify again, it's not open to commercial passengers. It's for private business and intended to generate some income for the county.
Well, listen, you can charter a flight there if you want, and you're willing to pay for that, but there's not going to be commercial flights. There were years ago when the airport first opened, there was scheduled commercial service. That didn't work out. And if you just heard, Stewart Airport just lost Play Airlines. So that's not a go for us to do that kind of thing. That's just setting it up for failure. What we're trying to do with this new terminal is to make it a attractive destination for the business aviation community, jets, the people who cater to jets, pilots, because we're pretty close to New York City by a jet, really only about 20-minute flight time. But we have much lower rates and much more room than closer general aviation airports like Teterboro, Westchester. We're not talking about competing with LaGuardia, Newark, JFK, although even there, I bet you they don't have much room left, and it's a lot of money to rent space there. So come on up to Sullivan County International. We've got the room. We've got the fuel. We've got the length of runway that can land a Boeing 727. So, hey, we're open for business.
couple of things to honor some folks before we go. Congratulations to two older New Yorker honorees from Sullivan County, Gail Irving and Sabina Toomey. Our 2025 older New Yorkers.
Yes, Gail from Grahamsville, Sabina from Forestburg. They were nominated by our Office for the Aging to receive Older New Yorker of the Year awards up at the New York State Office of Aging, where they got to go up to Albany in May and really just get celebrated and given a wonderful meal, have their photo taken. I'm going to have a press release out today giving some explanation about why these people are just so wonderful and why they deserved these awards. But for now, I just want to say congratulations, Gail and Sabina. We are so privileged and lucky to have you in our community.
Congratulations. And also Juneteenth is a holiday on Thursday. It's the legislature meeting on that
yep,
day.
This
and
meeting on Thursday.
Honoring a family.
Yep. Currently, the county does not have that as a holiday. It's got to be negotiated in the labor contracts, but that is the intent for future Juneteenths to be a day off. But until such time, the legislature wants to mark it and recognize it, particularly legislator Amanda Ward, an African-American herself who knows an African-American family, the Watsons, in Sullivan County that have just had a wonderful impact on the community or involved in law enforcement. We're going to be honoring them at the full board meeting on Thursday and recognizing Juneteenth as a whole for its meaning and impact on the U.S.
All right. Dan Hoost, Sullivan County Government Communications Director. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next Friday.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Have a good weekend. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Deepwater Literary Festival is just 1 week away, and there's going to be some stuff for kids, too. We'll find out more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
June 22nd at 7 p.m., Bethel Woods Center for the Arts presents Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis, performing rare historic compositions and Jazz at Lincoln Center Commission works, now inviting kids 12 and under to sit free on the lawn. Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, June 22nd at Bethel Woods. Tickets on sale now at BethelWoodsCenter.org. Paid for by Bethel Woods Center for the Arts.
Are you ready to be better? Smarter? Who knows, maybe even taller? I'm Meg Wolitzer. Okay, no promises, but after the fiction in this week's selected shorts, you might be motivated to become a brand new you. Join me.
Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life, we visit a hospital in Africa, complete with beautiful operating rooms and flying drones that carry snakebite antivenom. They treated a big chunk of its country's people for absolutely free. In February, their funding was shut down when the Trump administration closed USAID. And now the people running this hospital are pondering what was good and what was bad about what they built here.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Deepwater Literary Festival is back in Narrowsburg, New York next weekend, and while it continues to spotlight bold ideas and celebrated writers, this year's lineup also makes space for younger readers and families. Plus, anyone with a love for discovering books off the beaten path at the second annual Independent Book Fair. Joining us now to talk about it are Aaron Hicklin, director of the Deepwater Literary Festival, and Ahu Terzi of The Hound Books. Good morning.
Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Aaron, I want to talk to you a little bit more about kids. Why is it important to include kid-friendly programming in the Deepwater Festival lineup, and how does it align with your broader mission?
Well, kids are big readers, for a start, and kids are our future. I mean, it's obvious, but I think it always needs restating. We want a future generation of well-read, engaged, people who can, who can reason and rationalize, and books are a way to do that. But much more important, they're a way to stimulate the imagination. Storytelling starts really in infancy with parents reading to their kids. And if we don't have a part to play in encouraging that, then what good is a literary festival? But also, I think, there are lots of parents who want to do things during the festival. They can drop their kids off at some of these events and go off to a book panel, to one of our visual arts events, or just to grab a coffee.
One of them is Hot Dog, a canine creative session event that is going to have Doug Salati, a Caldecott Medal-winning illustrator. How did he get involved with the festival?
You know, like so many people, Tim, he walked into the store one day and we started talking and he was like, I happen to be an illustrator of children's books. I said, really? Which ones? And then when I found out he had won a Caldecott medal for Hot Dog, I started ordering. And, you know, it's been one of our best sellers. I mean, it's a huge success, that book. Ahu wouldn't know it well. I know she's done an event with Doug.
Yeah.
You know, he lives in the area. And, you know, this is, I think, the secret to deep water, but also to running bookstores. Any small independent bookstore is so much talent walks in, crosses the threshold. And my job often as a, you know, as a bookseller, as a director of a festival is to book them, to say, come back, for these 3 days in June. We want to do something with you.
I didn't mention, but many folks know you are the proprietor of One Grand Books. Ahu, you are the proprietor of The Hound Books in Roscoe. And how did you become involved with the Independent Book Fair? And what can you tell folks about the second year of the Independent Book Fair? What's new or different this time around?
Sure. Well, Aaron asked, and when Aaron asked, you don't say no. That's how I got involved last year. And we're back at the Narrowsburg Union again this year. I don't know if all of the listeners know the union, but it's an iconic building in Narrowsburg. It's the former Central Rural School House, and it's been repurposed as a multi-use commercial facility. And its mission is to make room for new ideas to germinate and flourish. So I think it's the perfect place, to be honest with you, to house the Independent Book Fair. We've invited independent presses from the New York State, tri-state area, and they're going to exhibit. They're going to each have their own tables. They play a pivotal role, I think, in shaping the current literary landscape, but I think it's also important to note that most of them lost their National Endowment for the Arts grants this past May. So the cuts were new and unexpected, and I think just attending the book fair and showing your appreciation is really, really important.
Can you share a few standout examples that might intrigue readers of folks who are going to be there, those voices at the book fair, those independent presses?
Yeah, I loved having Nice Boat Books and Blackstone Lit, two of the great presses that exhibited last year. They're back among other publishers who are back. This year we also have Ugly Duckling Press, who's coming in. It's been around for a very long time. In the 90s, it was a zine, a mission-driven small press that published zines. But through an editorial collective, they've turned into a small publisher and published more than 400 titles to date. I think you're going to like their books. Current Punks Press is another independent publisher who's coming in. There are two books I want to highlight.
Yeah.
One is Shadow Talk by McPherson. It's 25 new fairy tales by Robert Kelly with original drawings by Emma Polakoff. And you'll find stories about a boy who inhabits a camel and a butterfly shepherd who's also a cat. So I think that's kind of cool that we have new fairy tales.
Yeah, more family-friendly, kid-relatable stuff there, too.
Yeah.
The other event for kids, Aaron, is the Ad Libs Story Hour. It sounds really creative and also unpredictable. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's going to be as much as a surprise to me as it is probably to the attendees. But this is organized by another local bookstore, Ratty Books in Jeffersonville. Ratty Books is a store dedicated to children's books, young people's books. And this is a story time party for, let's say, tiny dreamers, big imaginations, and everyone in between. It's really about co-creating a tale with a storyteller. The storyteller is Steve Yacino. He's a journalist and a documentary maker. So he's used to building stories from scratch. That's what the kids will be doing. It could be a farting squirrel or a ninja cupcake. You get to decide whose story you're telling. You know, I think bring your parents, bring your grandparents, even your favorite stuffed animal. let's be honest, they've got opinions too. So that's happening at 11 a.m. on Sunday at the Derby Hotel, which is just across the bridge, technically in Beach Lake, but really, you know, a stone's throw from Narrowsburg Main Street. And that's also where the Doug Saladi event will be happening on Saturday the 21st. That's happening also in the morning at 9:30 a.m. So we're really using that space there, which is really beautiful in the back. There's a barn. It's, you know, there's coffee and refreshments in the hotel lobby for those who want them. There's a lot of grass out there for people to sort of run around in. So it's a great location, and you can make a lot of noise. There's no homes nearby.
Good place for the kids to go. Let's remind folks where they can get more information about this year's Deepwater Literary Festival coming up. Just in 1 week. Can you believe it?
I can't, but I'm
I can't.
Really-
Aaron, let's remind folks where they can get more information about all of the programs that are going on.
The most important fact, deepwaterfestival.com has the full program. You can reserve for all of these events. Most of them are free. Some of them are ticketed. There's also paper programs. They will be available from today around Narrowsburg in places like One Grand Books and also at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance on Main Street, 37 Main Street. So look out for those. Often people prefer those to going online. You know, we love to be analog as well as digital here.
I want to ask you, Ahu, what are you personally most excited about this year at the book fair and also just the overall event? I could ask you the same, Aaron, but I expect your answer is that it will be over soon.
Everything.
Or everything.
Well, I have to be honest. So the book fair is all day on Saturday, and it's a free event. And this year, I believe the Narrowsburg Union is going to open up their cafe, and they have a beautiful seating. So it really can be an all-day activity for people to come and browse the books and also enjoy foods and drinks at the cafe. So I'm excited about that. But I'm also personally excited about hosting Rex Ogle, who's a YA author. I'm going to be interviewing him or chatting with him on stage. I think Aaron, you know exactly where it is. I forget, but I'm really excited about that conversation.
And that's
Rex.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say Rex is actually flying in from the West Coast to this. His books are incredible, award-winning kind of memoirs, really, for YA readers that tackle all sorts of tough subjects from poverty and abuse to survival. But there's a lot of humor in those books. There's no sugarcoating. And Ahu will be leading that conversation with him. He also does a lot of graphic novels, really fun graphic novels for kids. That's going to be at the Krauss Recital Hall in the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. Again, that's 37 Main Street, and it's on Saturday at 3:30 p.m., the 21st of June.
It's Aaron Hicklin, who is the co-director and founder of the Deepwater Literary Festival, also operator of One Grand Books, and the host of Shelf Life here on Radio Catskill on Sundays at noon. And Ahu Terzi of The Hound Bookstore, who's curating the festival's independent book fair for the second year in a row. There's more information at deepwaterfestival.com. Thanks to you both, and we'll see you in a week.
See you then.
Thank you. Thanks. See you then. Bye.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest episode of Curtain Call, our local theater podcast. Tom Candela's here. After this, it's Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Papa don't take no mess next time on Jazz Night in America as we celebrate Father's Day. We'll hear music and stories from Catherine Russell, Corey Wong, Madison and Bobby McFerrin, and more. That's coming up on Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
You You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Friday, it's the new episode of our podcast, Curtain Call, with Tom Candela, the local theater podcast. And Tom is here with a preview. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. And thank you again for having me.
Who's on this episode?
So we've got the Delaware Valley Opera Company. Yes, very good opera company. They recently purchased, well, back in 2021, they purchased The Nutshell over in Huntington, Lake Huntington, right?
Yes.
Yes. And They're operating out of there now. It's their new home. So I went to go see one of their productions, Nightly News, which is on this weekend, as a matter of fact. There's two performances tomorrow at 10 and 2 p.m. and then one on Sunday at 2. I went to go see it, and I included that our interview with the audience members and some of the cast members, you know, on this show, on this episode.
All right, let's take a listen. It's a preview of the Curtain Call podcast. The full episode drops today at WJFFradio.org. Yep. But here's Tom in a preview of Curtain Call today.
For 35 years, the Delaware Valley Opera has brought the power and beauty of operatic performance to audiences across Sullivan County. And on the show today, we are welcoming the Delaware Valley Opera president of the company, and her name is Suzanne DeBorkin.
Hello.
Suzanne, welcome to Curtain Call.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So give us a little history of the company itself. When did it start? Who is its founders?
Okay. The company started in 1986. It was part of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. That was an umbrella above us for a long time. And Gloria Krause was one of the founding members. Carol Diefenbach is our board emeritus. So we have put on shows continuously ever since that date, with the one exception of COVID in 2019. We never really had a place of our own. And we were very fortunate in 2021 that The Nutshell became available, and we were able, with the help of an angel, to purchase it. I'm sure there are many, many people that are listening to you now that have, that are very familiar with the old Nutshell. Mm-hmm. We've kept it somewhat the same. The smaller space, we named it the Arts Nest. And that's a small cabaret space, and it's a listening space. There's an open mic that comes every Tuesday evening. And then throughout the year, we've had Saturday night singer-songwriter and certain different other performers come on Saturday nights for shows.
So right now you have a show that's getting ready soon. Tell us about the show.
The show's name is Nightly News, K-N-I-G-H-T. And it's written L-Y. And it's written by a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Stinson, who's a singer. He's sung with us for several years. And he's our artist in residence this summer because he wrote the music for Nightly News. He's directing Speed Dating, which is our July show. And then he's going to be singing in Don Giovanni.
So the children's production.
Yes.
Nightly News. Is it based on fables?
It's based on fairy tales.
Fairy tales. Okay.
And yeah, there are four singers. And this year, I think it's really wonderful because we have a mixture of performers that have sung with us at least one time before, some of them more than once, and brand new singers, which is always wonderful to have different people come and be able to introduce them and the community to each other.
So a lot of things are happening over there. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, the characters are, the reason it's called Nightly News, Prince Charming is, he has a television program that he reads the news of the Enchanted Forest. And so he hears this, the stories of Pig and Red Riding Hood, and so does the wolf. And he runs the local coffee shop.
Okay.
And the real basis and the real story is that each character has to discover who they really are and then accept who they are and live their life that way. So I think that there are some good lessons to be learned by anybody of any age that comes and sees the show. And we're going to have a crafting time beforehand with some pieces that they can decorate in color that have to do with the show. Our financial officer, Deborah Courtright, is a major crafting person, and she's got, so she always loves to do that with the children.
That's great. So there's like a little pre-show beforehand.
Yep. Little pre-show fun.
So we have that show coming up, and how long does that run?
That runs two weekends. So the Saturday 7 and 14, there are two shows that day on Saturday, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Okay. And then the Sundays are 8 and 15, and that's again at 2 p.m.
So what's next after this show?
So the next show that's going to happen is in July, and it's called Speed Dating Tonight.
Okay.
It's by an American composer named Michael Cheng. And his concept was very original and innovative, I think. Instead of writing an opera with two acts, three acts, four acts, he wrote 108 separate vignettes. So depending on how many singers you have, the level of their experience, how long you want your show to be, you just pick what the vignettes that appeal to you or you match with your singers. The underlying theme is that it is a speed dating evening, and so the characters are coming to meet somebody. And one of the aspects recently of opera is to make it more interactive and immersive. So the audience will be mixed in with the performers. And I think that that's going to be very fun. And okay. So Jonathan Stinson is directing that one.
Okay.
And Nightly News is directed by Carol Castell, who's our artistic director. So she's doing that. And then she'll do the Don Giovanni in August. That's the big one with the orchestra. We have a different pianist for that because that's Martin will be the conductor for that.
Give us the dates again for that.
Speed Dating opens on the 12th, Saturday the 12th of July. 12 and 19 are at 7 p.m. and July 13 and 20 are at 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
Okay. And then Don Giovanni. Let's go
on to that.
Because that is a big production. Big cast, right?
It's a pretty big cast, yeah. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few people. And again, it's a mixture of people that have sung with us before and brand new.
Okay.
So that's wonderful.
What do you see as president? What do you see for your future?
My vision is to have, as Sullivan County grows and becomes more of a touristy destination, that we're definitely on people's radar as something to do when they come to Sullivan County. If you've never seen an opera, if you've never tried an opera, come and give us a try. It's entertaining. Opera, after all, is entertaining. It's a way to spend an evening.
How do we get tickets to your show?
You can just walk in the door and buy them at the door.
Okay.
We are also on River Tickets.
My
River Tickets through the River Reporter.
So again, myrivertickets.com.
Yes.
Or we can go to your website again. Give us that.
It is www.delawarevalleyopera.org.
Very good. And that was Suzanne Dvorkin from Delaware Valley Opera. Now, last weekend, I took the wife out to go see the show, Nightly News, and we really had a nice time. And as a special part of this show today, I'm going to give you a little bit of what the audience and cast members had to say. All right, we're with a good kid over here named Charlie. Charlie, what's your last name?
Schroeder.
Charlie Schroeder. Charlie, so you just saw an opera at the Delaware Valley Opera. What did you think of the show?
I think it was pretty good.
Is this your first time seeing opera?
No, I've been there a bunch of times, like with other opera places. Like, I've been to the South Fallsburg one, and also I went to Carnegie Hall.
So how do you think this compares?
I don't really want to say which one's better because...
You know what? That's a really smart answer. It really is. Is that your brother?
Yep.
What's your name?
My name's John.
I'm guessing that you have seen opera before, too. Is that right?
Yes.
And how did you like today's show? Did you have a good time?
I did have a good time.
What do you think happened with the Big Bad Wolf at the end of the show?
He kind of wanted to be bad, but he didn't turn out to be bad in the end.
That's right. He failed at being bad, right?
Come back to Delaware Valley Opera to see more amazing shows. And bye-bye. Yeah. Come back for more plays and operas because they're really fun.
That's great, boys. I love it. We're now with the cast of this wonderful show, Nightly News, that we just saw. Kids are loving it. I spoke with a few of the audience members today, and they really enjoyed it. You kept the kids' attention, which is amazing. So give us your full name.
My name is Veronica Mack.
Veronica Mack, and you are?
I'm Margot Frolick.
Margot Frolick.
And I'm Ramon Tenefrancia.
Very nice to meet all of you. So tell me, what brought you up to this area?
Well, I also did a production with a DVO last summer. I was in The Old Maid and the Thief, and I sang Letitia. And from my personal experience with them last year, I enjoyed everything about it, from working with Carol and Martin to working with my castmates, and everyone just provides such a really warm and friendly environment. And of course, we're here for opera, right? Yes. So it just only encourages everyone to enjoy and also tell a story,
yes,
especially if it's something funny like Nightly News. And we love to be able to provide a space for kids to enjoy opera too.
I think what this does is introduce children to the art of opera. They actually get to come to theater and see a different art form like opera, I think, is very important. What do you think?
This is my first time participating in a production with DBO. It came highly recommended by my two colleagues here, Veronica and Ramon, as well as some people in Manhattan. And I've had such a great experience working with Carol and Martin, and Nightly News has really been a joy to perform.
That's wonderful. And you've traveled in other countries singing in different languages, correct? And where was that?
Last summer, I sang in Italy in Cinderella by Pauline Viardot, another sort of fairy tale as well. And it's nice to sing in New York, which is my home state.
Very nice. And Ramon, what about yourself?
So I'm also a DVO alum. I was here last year. I sang Little Bat with DVO Susanna. And I actually got to work with the composer of Nightly News, Jonathan Simpson, last year as well. He was telling me about this, and when Carol asked me if I could sing Prince Charming, I said, 100%, yes, this is, I want to try singing his music. It was amazing.
And I think you did a really good job. It really, the kids, because I was watching the audience, and the kids really honed into your performance there and really appreciated that. So it's really good job, all three of you, really. And I think you bring a lot to our community. It's important. You know, we're a smaller community out here, and we do love bringing in folks from out of state, from different countries into our community to participate and bring their wonderful art. So thank you all of you for participating in Curtain Call. And that was some of the audience members and the cast of Nightly News over at the Delaware Valley Opera Center in Lake Huntington, New York. So I would definitely suggest when you get a moment to go out and see the rest of their shows on the 14th. The coming up Nightly News is at 10 a.m. and then a repeat performance at 2 p.m. And on the 15th, that performance is at 2 p.m. Again, that's in Lake Huntington. So go out there, folks, support the Delaware Valley Opera, support theater as a whole, and have a good time with the kids.
Tom Candela with Curtain Call. It's our local theater podcast, and new episodes drop every Friday at our website. Just go to wjffradio.org and click on the tab at the top that says shows. There's a drop down. You'll see podcasts, and there you can find it, along with all of our other podcasts and community voices that we host there. And there's links to all of our local programming as well. wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Forestburg Playhouse, presenting Boeing Boeing, June 17th through the 22nd. The mile-high comedy that's sure to keep audiences laughing. Tickets at ForestburgPlayhouse.org. And from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. And support also comes from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You ever feel tired of that voice in your mind that just won't be quiet?
It's not just the noise in the world I'm trying to get away from, but it's the chatter in my head.
Writer Pico Iyer has found his antidote, and he has ideas for how to find yours. Great Escapes. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
On this Old House Radio Hour, cleaning guru Brandon Plaschek shares his best-kept secrets for spotless surfaces and DIY cleaning potions.
One tool that I would say is like a massive game changer and I recommend pretty much to anyone is a drill brush scrubber.
Plus, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal thought he had found a perfect post-divorce retreat. Instead, he wound up with the house from hell. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. The forecast, partly cloudy today, a high 73. Rain coming back into the forecast tonight early. The rain showers will evolve into a more steady rain overnight. Rainfall near a quarter of an inch and a low of 56. Tomorrow, looks like the rain might spoil Saturday a bit. Steady rain in the morning, showers continuing in the afternoon, a high of 62. Cloudy Saturday, 52 for a low. Sunday, cloudy, slight chance of a rain shower, but only at 15%. and a high of 64. By Monday, temperatures still lingering in the mid-60s, back up into near 80 by Wednesday with some showers and thunderstorms.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.